The KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and I'm joined in the studio by Craig Tucker of the KM Sports Desk. Our guest this week is a current league winner and also a former Gillingham player and manager. He started his career at Norwich but quickly found a home at Bournemouth before moving to Priestfield in 1996. 12 months after playoff final heartache at Wembley, he was Gillingham captain in 2000 when they beat Wigan to win promotion. He retired from playing in 2003 and after spells at Ebbsfleet and Welling, took a coaching job in Stoke's academy. Under Tony Pulis, he was promoted to first team coach in 2011 before being the main man again in 2013 at Forest Green. He returned to Gillingham when he became first team manager in January 2017, but his spell in charge lasted only 265 days as they picked up just 6 wins in 32 games. He embarked on a new adventure a year or so ago in Brunei, of all places, and he returns to these shores as a champion, having won the Singapore Premier League at the first time of asking. So it's a very warm welcome to one of football's nicest and possibly funniest guys, as Adrian Pennant joins us on the podcast.
Hiya, gents. Hello there.
Good to see you, Adi. Thanks very much for coming in. We'll start with your success in Brunei. We should really ask, first of all, how it all came about. I mean, it's been an amazing past 12 months or hasn't it?
It's been surreal, really. Everyone knew I had a knee problem when I first came to Gillingham as a player. A year ago, in last May, just gone, I had a full knee replacement. And then a month after that, I had a phone call from a gentleman from DPMM, Brunei DPMM, saying would I be interested in coming over to have talks about being the head coach over there. And I'll be honest with you, I thought it was a wind up, and you know, I'm sitting there and I'm going to be missing, you know, I've got my leg up and you know, I've got a million staples in my leg, and I said to me miss, oh, there's a bloke on here, broken English, blah blah blah, talking about place in Brunei. I didn't even know where Brunei was, I'll be honest with you. I knew that Zesh Raymond had trials there, because I had Zesh obviously at Gillingham. I got Zesh in at Gillingham when I was manager there, and for a short time, and I knew Zesh had trials there about 4 or 5 years ago. So I thought, I said to myself, I'm just going to call him just to see if it was true or not, because you just never know. And then he said, yeah, there's a gentleman called Ali from DPMM, Brunei DPMM, called me, Zesh. He went, yeah, he's the like part of the management of DPMM when I was there. I went, oh, really? So I'm thinking, oh, sugar. I thought, cut long story short, said thanks, Zesh, and phoned this gentleman, Ali, back, and he invited me over in November to watch the last game of the season. Went over there and for 6 days and met the Crown Prince on the second day I was over there, which was, it was surreal, really. I'm sitting there in his palace. Just words can't describe the wealth of what's over there, really. But a lovely, lovely man said to me, would I be interested, etc. And obviously watched the last game of the season. And I said, obviously, I came back, spoke to Tanya, my wife, and the children, because there's obviously children, a massive part of the decision also, because I have two grandchildren also. So I decided to take up the offer, and it was a case of obviously different experience. Always wanted to coach abroad also, but the biggest thing really, I went over there for the 6 days, and in such a lovely country, beautiful country, good people, and it was a chance to obviously get back in football near enough straight away.
Have you found the different cultures and presumably traditions and what have you that you have to embrace over there as well?
That was the biggest thing I wanted to do, was embrace the culture, and there's no point in me going over there, because Brunei is a predominantly Muslim country. Ramadan, for the month of Ramadan, was very different. You know, obviously we had two or three games during Ramadan, and as everybody knows, my player, we're the only Muslim team over there, you know, that does Ramadan, and because the other team's from Singapore. Got one team, Albrex, from Japan, but we are the only Muslim team over there. And through Ramadan, it was a bit strange, really, because the players hadn't eaten or drunk anything from 5:30 in the morning until seven. You know, until they were allowed in Singapore at 7 o'clock was in the evening, because we had a game at 7:30. So the warm up was totally different. The game, just everything, preparation went out the window. You know, me and the fitness coach, we was buying bananas. Sandwiches, obviously protein drinks, you know, all the proper supplements, so they could eat, but not fill them up too much, because in the warm up they were feeling dizzy in the warm up, you know, because obviously they hadn't eaten and drunk so much. Didn't want to give them too much because they'd be too bloated for the game. But luckily enough, we in the two or three games we went 2 or 3 nil up in the first half. So second half we completely went, you know, it was like a case of hanging on. You know, I think we won one game 3-1. I think we won another game 2-0 and 1-0, I think the other games were in Ramadan. So it was an unbelievable effort for the players. But the second half was we were just out on our feet. But we were organised and, you know, and we, lucky enough, we through Ramadan, you know, it was we won those games. But the whole it's an absolutely stunning country. Brunei is built on a jungle. You know, even in, you know, I'll give an example, even you go shopping, you know, the shopping, obviously, you've got the shopping centre, and then just in the car park is where the jungle, you know, obviously the jungle, you see all these monkeys coming at the jungle, and it's a fantastic country. It's unbelievable. And you've got saltwater crocodiles, you can't swim in the sea, obviously, not that I would never swim in the sea, mind you, but if you did, you know, there's saltwater crocodiles there, and in the water, there's a water village there, obviously, where the crocodiles go, and people still swim in the river there. Honestly, it's incredible. I walk in the jungle at least once a week, because obviously, you know, it's again the noise of the jungle. Honestly, mate, it's hard to explain, really. But it's a fantastic experience. Obviously, to win the league in the first season, it was a great achievement from everybody involved.
How did you manage that? Because they were third, weren't they, the season before? What was your expectation, and what was your instruction from them? Where did they want to finish in that season? Was it top three again, or did you surpass what they wanted to do?
Obviously, when I spoke to the management, because obviously I'm the head coach, and I've got five or six people above me, which they call the management, and they're just obviously for the finances, etc. And then obviously you've got the Crown Prince, who's the chairman. But no, when I met the management and the Crown Prince, they were just saying mid-table. Obviously I've come from England, and they were expecting obviously mid-table because of some changes to be done. And yeah, so really how I work with all my teams, pre-season is so important, and we were training in the jungle. Which again was, you know, surreal. You know, got to be careful of the snakes, got to be careful of the monkeys, you know, but a lot of hill runs in pre-season. The culture again in Brunei and in Asia in general, even in Singapore, players, they eat and drink the wrong things. So, you know, we were doing double sessions. We were doing like, obviously, because we had to train early in the morning for, obviously, I'm talking about pre-season. We were doing jungle runs at 7 o'clock in the morning. Then we're going in the gym, which is indoors, which is all air conditioning. We're going in the gym at 10. And then in the afternoon, obviously, because throughout the season, we always trained at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, obviously, because the heat during the day is so hot. So we're doing three sessions a day in the first 2 weeks, again, you're trying to tell them to eat and drink the right things, but that was difficult. You couldn't really control that unless they gave me full control, but they didn't. You know, it's the way they live their life. They eat and drink rubbish, I'll be honest with you. But as the season went on, they were listening, because obviously, again, results dictate. We had a fantastic start. I think we were unbeaten in 12 games. And they could see the definition in their bodies also. You know, they obviously were going to the gym a lot, spinning classes. We just really worked them very hard, and it was a case of really going in there and starting. They weren't used to the training that I do. So, and all season we didn't have one muscle injury, which is incredible. And I'm a great believer. Everywhere I've been, especially in pre-season, I do work the boys very hard, get a lot of mileage in their legs, especially their thighs, their hamstrings, with the hill runs and blah, blah, blah. People call it old-fashioned, but, you know, if you look at the so-called top clubs now, the Chelsea's, the Man United's and the Arsenal's, they all do hill runs now. And so it's like a fashion that goes around. But I've done it all the way through, and that's through Tony Pulis. And to have no muscle injuries all season was a fantastic. But in all the clubs I've been at, in the coaching side of it, we're very, very lucky where we don't have many muscle injuries, because I do work very hard in that pre-season.
What's the standard of football like over there as well? How would you measure it compared to our football?
Yeah, difficult to measure, because, as you know, in Asia they're not obviously built like us. You know, in Europe they're small. Technically footballing wise, and technical side of it, very, very good. But would they compete in the English Football League? Technically, yes. But physicality, no, because obviously they're, you know, the goalkeeper, you know, I've got three goalkeepers over there, and I'd say the tallest would be 5'10", whereas where I've been in management, as a coach or whatever, wherever I've been at, always like a big goalkeeper who's got to be 6'3", 6'5", plus, you know what I mean? So but I was allowed, when I went over there, and I started the contract on the 1st of December. So I went over the 1st of December, and the first 10 days was all trial games, because we're allowed three overseas players. So I remember turning up, and obviously There was no English. I was the only English coach there. They want me to coach the coaches over there. So I had an assistant coach who was from Brunei, goalkeeper coach from Brazil, who was there before. He was from Brazil. Didn't speak a word of English, to be honest with you. But I've turned up on the first Saturday, on the 1st December, and there must have been about 60 Brunei players and 30 overseas players. And I'm talking about around the world, British players, European players, Asian players, Australasian players, South American players, Argentina, Brazil, Australia, around the whole world. And they said, oh, just get on with it, basically. So I arranged, obviously done coaching sessions, and we arranged games between ourselves, and then I had to pick three from the overseas players, the three best ones. And I wanted to go for the core of the side. I wanted a centre-half, centre midfield player, and a centre-forward overseas. Then the rest have to be from Brunei. You know, not from Singapore, have to be from Brunei. So I got a centre-half from, which I had, Charlie Clough I got him from Sutton when I was at Forest Green. Again, I interviewed Charlie, see if he'd be interested. Interviewed a lot of British players while I was in. This is before December. Me and my agent, because we wanted to do it right and get the right character. Because to go over to Asia, to Brunei, I didn't want the players, you know, have a young family. Unless they all come over, I didn't want them to come home to England every 5 minutes. They had to be committed, like I was. I had to be committed and be full on. So I got Charlie over. Obviously, he was single, very keen to work abroad, which he always has done. And another thing, obviously, he's a very good player. Ideal what we wanted, so I signed Charlie. I signed an Australian lad from, Blake Ricutu from Australia. I signed him. Again, he was a little bit bigger and stronger than everyone else. Just run all day. Technically good as well. Centre forward from Belarus, who again, his movement, I watched his movement, was fantastic movement he got, and a good finisher. But he was 30, 31, had a young family, but he said he would bring all his family over to Brunei from Belarus, so that worked out well. And to be fair, all three players have, at the end of the season, got into the team of the year, which is a big plus. That's the first time the club's ever done it, and so that was great. And then obviously with the 60 players, I had to pick 22 Brunei players out of those 60 players. This all happened in 10 days, so it's full on. And obviously me climatising as well, because you know, it's 36, 40 degrees in Brunei. It cost me a fortune, in fact, a 50, I can assure you. I'm coaching, I'm sweating, you know. You get climatised eventually. I got used to it in the end. That, you know, wearing caps, and oh, it was so hot. And humidity level was something like 92 degrees. So I had to acclimatise to it as well. But it was good. I wanted to hit the road running. And like I say, expectation levels wasn't high, which obviously helped also. And we'd done a Leicester, really, because nobody was expecting us to do well. Everyone was talking about Home United and all the other clubs around in Singapore. And yeah, we had a very good start and carried on.
So then, once you win the league, what was the reception and everything? I mean, you're
incredible.
Presumably, you're a hero over there now. Yeah?
Oh, I wouldn't say hero, but it was incredible. And you know, the last game we won the league, we had one home game to go, and obviously that was the trophy ceremony, and we won that game 5-4. It was unbelievable, really. It was a 5-4 game, and it was so open. But we had a crowd of just under 20,000 turn up. You know, singing and dancing, drums, everything. You know, it was fantastic, and. You know, it's a memory that, you know, I'm how I live my life, and I tell my children I'm here to make memories for my children, my grandchildren, my wife, obviously. I'm here to make memories, and hopefully that's what I've done for people in Brunei. And that last game was incredible, incredible. It was the noise and just the, and obviously the trophy was so heavy, beautiful trophy. Obviously the crowd come on the pitch, you know, I was holding this trophy for half an hour, I'm not joking, Matt, and it was so heavy. My arms were like Popeye when I finished, honestly. But it was just that feeling of being that winner, being a winner, and obviously it's a tough season, you know, a very tough season. And then I had to get the players up after that, and we won the league. They started like the equivalent of RFA Cup, so we got the semi-finals. The FA Cup, we lost on penalties, and as you know, I've never been good on penalties anyway. But I think we
take one, did you?
No, I didn't. No, thank God for that. But it was hard to get the players up, and we was away in Singapore, you know, that we weren't allowed to play home games. It was all the way in Singapore, the cup games. So, but we got to the semi-final, we lost on penalties, but we were spent. We, you know, the players were so knackered, and they gave me everything, and but so proud of them. You know, to what they done. You know, I'm talking about the players, what they done in what I asked them to do was just incredible, incredible. And they were never used to it. And, you know, and I said to them, you know, they were my family, they were my children, really, to be fair, when I first go over there. And we had a really good, relationship. I've still got a good relationship with all the players, you know. And so, and it was nice. They were even saying, if I didn't go back next year, about 10 of them were going to retire. But it was nice, you know, it was a great match, a very good match. But tough, mind you, being away from the family and children. Unbelievably tough.
We've had Jamie Day in on the podcast before, and he's obviously doing the Bangladesh experience. Mm. How have you found the family? That's obviously the biggest thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, to be fair, in all my management, right, except for obviously the Welling and the Gillingham, I've always travelled, you know, Stoke, Forest Green, Barrow. I've always travelled and been away, but this is obviously totally different. You know, I couldn't come home for the weekend. I've got an unbelievable wife. She's fantastic, my wife. And, you know, the children have come over, except for the oldest one, Jason, hasn't come over. But hopefully next season, Jay will come over with Sophie, my daughter-in-law, and Harry, my grandson. But even Ash, Josie, and my youngest, Jasper, he's just turned one, but he came over when he's 4 months old. Already for a young and he's had a great life experience already. But and obviously Daniel and Chloe and Nathan have been over also, so you know it's tough. It's tough for me, obviously, and obviously tough for my wife because she's still got to look after the children and the grandchildren. And obviously I'm such a great fella as well. I mean, I'm a great husband. Every day's Christmas Day for her, isn't it, to be married to me. But it was tough. The toughest times for me was the downtime. When I'm not coaching, when we haven't got games, it was downtime really, and it's obviously because the time difference is 8 hours. We're 8 hours ahead in Brunei. That was the toughest time, but it always helps when you win things.
And you're going back for another year.
The day I came home, they wanted me to sign just before the day I came. They didn't want me to come home without signing. So I've signed for another year, and it'll be tough because obviously, as we all know, it's tough on the second year. We've got an older squad, but. And everybody know what we're all about. Obviously, like I say, we were a Leicester. We surprised everybody, and obviously Leicester hasn't done it since. But again, it's a challenge and something that I'll look forward to.
Did you have a chance to go elsewhere? Was it an opportunity of staying there or what?
There's been enough to win the Singapore Premier League. It's opened up a lot of doors in Asia. You know, Indonesia. Inquiries of Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, but. I just want to be loyal to them. I'm a very loyal person, and they gave me the opportunity in Brunei, so I'll repay that back and just see how it goes next season.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
You started at Norwich. You're a well-known Ipswich fan. The rivalry is big, isn't it?
Yeah, it
is. Between those two clubs. What was that like? Bit of Mickey taking, and I should imagine, all the sort of stuff that goes with it.
I'll tell you what happened with that one. I was a late developer, as they say. I was playing for Suffolk. Obviously, I'm an Ipswich boy. Obviously, our family is huge Ipswich Town fans, and I still am. And we all still are, sorry. So I was playing for Suffolk, and a gentleman came up to my dad and said, look, he was a Watford scout. And he said, would AD like to come, obviously, have some trials at Watford? So went to Watford, and that's the first time I met Barry Ashby, actually. Obviously, Barry Ashby was at Watford then, and I was only 14, 15. David James was goalkeeper then. And I went up for a 4 or 5 Sunday. It was on a Sunday, the games were. So that was a great experience. Tom Wally was the manager then. Then I was obviously come back to Ipswich, back to school and this and the other. All my mates, one of my mates was playing for England, schoolboys. I still hadn't signed schoolboy forms for anybody. Went down to Ipswich, had a couple of training sessions at Ipswich. The story come about really was with the Norwich situation. I was a newspaper boy, a local news agent around the corner where I lived, and I was going down the hill with me bag, paper bag, and going down. I was going down this hill, and my bag got stuck in the front of the wheel. So I went over the top of the handlebars and smashed my face on the road. Went back. Obviously, I was cut, and my nose was bleeding area. Cut all over the show, and went back to the shop. The manager of the shop phoned my dad up. Said, "Hey, he's had an accident." Blah blah blah. He come. And my dad said, "Look, he doesn't want to." He doesn't do this anymore. He wants to become a footballer. And then the manager of the news agency, "Oh, really?" He said, "Well, I'm a Norwich City scout. I'll come watch AD on a Sunday." I used to play for William Browns and Dewson Juniors then in Ipswich. Went there, and then out of the blue, Ken Brown called my mum and dad up and said, "We'd like you to, you know, take me mum and dad out for dinner. Bring AD down to Norwich." All the management staff was there: Ken Brown, Mel Machin, K- Keith Webb, all, you know, all the first, and took my mum and dad and myself out for dinner. And cut long story short, my dad said, look, I want you to sign for Norwich. And we was all shocked. I was shocked as well. But they did look after mum and dad. You know, they really made an effort. So if it wasn't for me going over the handlebars and thrashing my face up, you know, I wouldn't know nothing about Norwich. You know, it's just a small world, unbelievable small world. There was one time when there was, obviously we played Ipswich and Norwich, obviously in the youth games, but we had a final. I think it was a Southern Junior Floodlit Cup final. It's Ipswich versus Norwich at Portman Road. I was captain of the youth team, so I had all my family Ipswich Town scarves and flags, and some half of me in Norwich flags and scarves, and this and the other. So, and we won at Portman Road, and I'm me lifting up. You know, I'm an Ipswich boy, in a stadium that I grew up with, Bobby Robson and all the Ipswich Town, the fantastic side they had then in the late 70s, early 80s. And I've got a Norwich City kit on, lifting up the trophy at Portman Road. It was surreal, really, you know. And but what I will say is my apprenticeship at Norwich was fantastic, and became a pro there as well. I made one first team appearance. Weren't good enough, obviously, to carry on being the top player in the Premiership. But one game against Southampton, where Letizia got a hat-trick against us. But again, fantastic. I really enjoyed the experience at Norwich. It was really good. It put me in good stead. But it was tough being an Ipswich fan, being in that Norwich shirt. But to be fair to Norwich, like I say, they looked after my mum and dad by, you know, wanting them to... They made a big effort for me to sign, so that's the reason why I signed.
Bournemouth, I think, that was the start of the knee injury, wasn't it? Bournemouth.
Yeah, I was at Norwich, and Harry Redknapp called me and said, I went to Norway for a year when I was at Norwich, and went alone for a year. Oggy Ryder was an ex-player at Norwich, and he was a manager at Molde, a team called Molde in Norway. So I went there for a year, and I absolutely loved it. It was first-team football. Came back, Norwich offered me a 2.5-year contract, and I said, no, I want my moving on now, because I had a taste of first-team football instead of playing in reserves all the time. So Harry Redknapp called me. They put my name out. Harry called me. Spoke to Harry. Tony Pulis was assistant manager then. He said he'd like to sign me, blah, blah, blah. Literally, maybe two or three days or a week later, Harry went to West Ham as manager. So I thought the deal was dead. Then Tony called me up the next day and said, well, we still like to sign you. So I went and saw Tone, and Dave Williams was there with Tony, and signed for Tony, and that's how it happened. And again, Tony, it was a really first time, obviously, I met Tony, and when I played for Bournemouth, and every time I played for Tony, I'd, if Tony said run for that brick wall, lady, I would. He's been incredible for my career as a player, and also in management, he's been unbelievable. And But even the time at Bournemouth, we had some good times, some fun times, funny stories at Bournemouth, unbelievable stories at Bournemouth, which I don't think we've got time to go through. But unfortunately, I snapped my knee when I was 23 there. We was away to Brighton. Before you laugh, mate, yes, I was chasing somebody because he went past me. So I turned to chase him, and my foot went one way, my knee went the other, and snapped my knee. And then obviously snapped my ACL. Got told at Bournemouth I'll never play football ever again, and that took me a good 18 months to get over that. Yeah, about 8 months to a year at Bournemouth doing rehab. Hadn't played any games, and then they came in, Bournemouth, the chairman and Mel Machin, who was the manager, said, we don't think you're ever going to play football ever again, and we're going to let you go on a free. My words were very strong at them. I said, I'll prove you wrong, but a lot of Fs and this, that and the other. And had a phone call from Tony, who was a manager at Gillingham, and he said, you know, we'll take a risk on you. Would you like to come here? We'll still do your rehab. I still had another 4 operations to have. I had 8 operations before I played again. And then obviously came to Gillingham and made my debut against Ipswich Town at Portman Road, which is phenomenal. Yeah, phenomenal.
Do you reckon anyone other than Tony Pulis would have given you another chance?
No, I don't. I really don't. My knee, you know, I slept with 4 operations, you know, and I was on a very basic, very low basic wage, but, you know, I had my first son. I was on basic wage, and he gave me that opportunity, obviously with Paul Scully, obviously gave me that opportunity to come to Gillingham. And again, even my debut for Gillingham, if it wasn't for Matty Bryant being shot when he went lamping in Bristol, Glenn Thomas nearly losing his eye, I wouldn't have made my debut against Ipswich in the Carling Cup, and that's how I made my debut. Again, a phenomenal story. It's just crazy how it all happens, but I'm a great believer in my life. Is always, you know, what will be, and fate. I do believe in fate, you know.
You mentioned Pulis, obviously running for a brick wall for him. What is it about him? How does he get that out of people? Because loads of people that played for him will say very similar things.
Yeah, man management is phenomenal. Don't get wrong, you know, I had him when he was in his first managerial, obviously at Bournemouth, his first managerial role, and you know, he was very strong. you know, very strong. He's very, you know, in your face, but very, very honest with it. You know, he wouldn't hide from his disappointment. You know, cups and everything flown all the time when he's at Bournemouth. And then when I went to, we met up again in, obviously in Gillingham, he changed, mellowed a little bit. Not much, but he mellowed a little bit. But then when I met up with him again in Stoke, when he was manager at Stoke, he completely changed. And that's testament to him, because football has changed over the years, hasn't it? You know, and you can't say what you used to say in those days, you know, and he's changed. And but his man management and just as a person, for me, he's just, I haven't got nothing bad to say about him. I said when we left Stoke, we got sacked at Stoke after being there for 6 years. You know, I was very fortunate he took me there and as youth team coach, and then from youth team coach to first team coach, you know, we got promotion to the Premiership from the Championship, FA Cup final, you know, even the semi final we beat Bolton 5-0, and you know, we're sitting back on the bench at Wembley in the semi final FA Cup that you dream of, you know, it's 4-0 with 5 minutes to go, and you know, the crowd is singing. Stoke fans were unbelievable then, they were singing Tony's name. They went 5-0 up, and you think, wow, the same, you know, this is just surreal again. It's incredible. And then obviously we lost to Man City in the semi-final of the cup. Again, going back to that, you know, who would have thought I'd been the coach in the semi-final of the FA Cup, because we got to the cup final, we qualified for Europa League. You know, we're going to Valencia, you know, we're going to Israel, you know, on a private jet, you know, going around Europe in a private jet in Europa League. And the experience at Stoke was incredible. Because of Tony, he believed in me and he liked the way I worked and that. And you know, we climbed Kilimanjaro together. For my career, he's been incredible, incredible.
We're going to ask about that, because your relationship kind of went to another level there, didn't it? Because he collapsed, is that right? And he sort of helped save you.
He said that he carried me down on his back, but you know, I'm 50 stone and he's only two stone three. But what happened with Kilimanjaro was, you know, we were near the summit and all of a sudden the heavens opened up. It was a blizzard. Absolutely, it was free. It went -40 in a space of like 2 minutes, and we couldn't see in front of our faces. They even said, like, obviously we had sticks as we were walking, and they said if you prod on the floor and it was solid, you walk on it. If it went through, don't walk on it because it's cloud. So you go to your death. You fall to your death. Now I had altitude sickness, and I was being physically sick, and blah blah blah. I got to the summit, nothing was coming up, but getting sick. But we had to rush up there. We'd done it in 3.5 days because at the time, I don't even remember, in Iceland, the volcano erupted in Iceland, so there was a lot of disruption with the plane. So we had to go by bus to Amsterdam and then fly from Amsterdam to Africa. So we lost 3 days. So we weren't climatised or anything. But as I was coming down from the summit, my legs, it was like bloomin' scarecrow. I just completely went. And because I was sick as well, you know, I wanted to go to sleep. I could have slept anywhere. So obviously you had Tone, the doc, we had other people around us. We just, how we got down, I never know. As we got to the summit, we got to the next level. As we coming down, there was these natives were there, and they put me in this wheelbarrow, covered me up, and they flew me down in this wheelbarrow to get down from altitude, you see. And then got down to the second level, which is the middle of the mountain. And I just went in this hut, I'm talking about Bob Basic Hut, and fell asleep for 2 or 3 hours. And the next minute, Tone's knocking on the door at this hut. And out of a party of, I think we had 26 people started the party, and that was with eight guides. We had eight guides. Only one went up to the summit with us. The rest had to go. And there's only six that went up and that got to the summit. So we got the T-shirt and all that sort of stuff. But we done it, and we raised a lot of money. We done it for, Tone is very big on the hospice in Stoke at the time, children's hospice. And also we used to go there a lot, and it's fantastic what they do at these hospices. It's phenomenal. So we raised a lot of money. It was Nick Hancock, Dave Seaman, Frankie, his wife. So we had some big hitters there. Obviously, I was unknown, but obviously Tone was well known. So I think they raised over 200 grand for the hospice, and it's fantastic, you know. But again, phenomenal experience. Mm. Even coming down from Kilimanjaro, we had no guide. So from the middle to the bottom, we had no guide. So we had to go through the jungle, and it was pitch black. And so it was me, Tone, the doc, who was about 70 years old. He was struggling massively because he couldn't see. Because of he couldn't see in daylight, not only bloody darkness. We lost all the lights, or, you know, all our torches. Frankie and Dave Seymour, who's coming down and going for the jungle. You've got baboons, you know, killer ant, not killer ant, but ants are this high. You know, if you went through one of those, then you know, you've got, these are like bullet ants, you know. And we couldn't see anything. Then I said to Tone, I remember being at the front, everyone's holding on the shoulders. It was, and you're coming down, you know, big old rocks, you're coming down. And I said, if anyone jumped out, I mean, I've got natives around as well, obviously, you know. I said, I'll kill them. I was at, you know, you've really pumped up. Obviously, the altitude sickness had gone by then, but my adrenaline was so pumping then. If even a baboon come and I would have ripped his head off, seriously, because your adrenaline's pumping. But we got to the bottom. How the hell we went through this jungle? But what helped us was this gentleman, a native, obviously, I saw in the distance this bobbing up and down. He had a light on his forehead and loads of stuff on top of his head. And he literally come past. I said, excuse me, can you take us down to the next level? And he, you know, after in his language, yes. So luckily for us, he guided us down through the jungle, you know, halfway through the jungle and then into the bottom. At the bottom, there was ambulances there and everything because the altitude sickness that a lot of people had and hypothermia was incredible. I think we had 5 or 6 people go to hospital because of altitude sickness and hypothermia. But again, you know, we don't do it in halves, do we? I knew what the time Kilimanjaro, obviously for charity, and and see the great scenery and this, that, and the other. And then we've got people in hospital, and you know, it's just an incredible story, really.
Two Gillingham games to ask about, obviously, the two playoff finals, the City one first. It was a strange one, wasn't it? Because obviously, it looked like Gills were going to win that game, yeah. And then there was a whole situation around Tony Pulis. I think there are a few rumours already doing the rounds that might be his last game.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, and obviously the penalty as well, which didn't go too great.
With the first game, it's my dream to play at Wembley. You know, who'd have thought that? You know, I'd be playing at Wembley in a final like that. It was a full house, you know, against Man City. You know, we played better in that game than we did against Wigan. I thought we played much better in the first game. I didn't really, for me and the players, we didn't really hear much that Tony was leaving after the game, or there was rumours of him leaving after the game, because we were just concentrating on the game, obviously. But that was just an incredible game, and the atmosphere, you know, just the thing with that team, which I've said from, you know, we had some fantastic players. I was very lucky to play with players. I wasn't an outstanding player, but we had, you know, Andy Hessenthaler, Carlos Saba, Bob Taylor, Guy Butters, Barry Ashby, Mark Patterson, Mark, you know, Vince Butler. I could go through the whole team, the whole squad. We had some very, very good players. But the team spirit we had was phenomenal. Absolutely, honestly, phenomenal. And you know, you've got to remember Paul Scully and obviously Tony spent money then. You know, they spent over £1 million on players. You know, and obviously when Peter Taylor came in the following year, he spent a bit of money on players. And that's the only time we've been in the Championship. So it's no surprise that, you know, we haven't spent much money since then. So you have to, me personally, I think you have to spend money to get in the Championship. And otherwise, Gillingham will be mid-table, lower half Division 1 team or Division 2 team and get promotion from Division 2. But, you know, if you're looking back, it's been over 20 years since they've played good money on players. You know, I think it was £245,000 or £250,000 for Hesse. Don't get me wrong, a fantastic player. The best player that I think Gillingham has ever had. You know, Paul Smith, you know, what a player he was. Got him from Brentford with Barry Ashby. Two fantastic players. You know, Bob Taylor, I was with Bob at Norwich in the early, you know, as an apprentice with me here with Bob Taylor. Spent money on him. Carlos Saba spent money. You know, the following year we spent money again on, you know, I'm not talking about like £10,000 here or there. We're talking about like £500,000 on player, you know, on just an individual player. But going off piece a little bit, the first game was incredible. Yeah, we went to Aston Villa before the game, and we practiced penalties. Gareth Southgate was there, and he had a great, record on penalties, didn't he, with England. But we went there. Even, you know, everyone took one, and I missed that penalty there, even in training. I never took a penalty in my life, so obviously I wasn't even on the record to take one. But I thought we played very well. The build up was phenomenal. Coming around in that on that coach and seeing all the Gillingham fans at the entrance of Wembley, I was filling up. I'm an emotional person anyway, and I was nearly in tears. I didn't, because obviously the boys were there, it was just unbelievable to see all them Gillingham fans there, and then going so close, you know, and then losing on penalty. Yeah, I missed a penalty, but it didn't really affect me. It affected my dad more than anything else. My dad still talked about that to this day. Oh yeah, you know, son, you missed a penalty. That didn't really affect me, because obviously Smudger, Paul Smith, and obviously Guy Butters missed as well. I think if I was the only one, Yes, yeah, it would affect me. And the other thing is, again, I'm a great believer in fate. Now, the following year, I was captain. My son was mascot, which is incredible. And we won. I went up to lift up the trophy. And I'm a great believer in fate. You know, if I hadn't missed, or the other boys hadn't missed, if we won that game, I wouldn't have gone the following year. Me being captain, my son being mascot, and me going up there to lift up the trophy. It's just dreams, just absolute dreams. And again, the second game, I think we took over, was it 50, 60,000 we took? I think the whole of Kent went. You know, again, coming, you know, at the end of the game, we won. The way it happened as well was similar to the Man City game, but reversed. Yeah, and weren't on penalties, but, you know, when Butt scored the header, and then obviously Tomo scored that header, was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And you dream of things like that, and I was getting paid in all my footballing life as a player. I had the best job in the world. I was getting paid what I love to do, and you can't beat that. I don't care what anyone says. Yes, I had injuries with my knee, broke my nose 3 times, tons of stitches in my head. But if someone said to me what I'd done in my footballing career, yeah, I went at the top level. But it didn't worry me. You know, as a kid, you want to play for England and I want to play for Ipswich in the Premier League, in the First Division then. But that didn't happen. But I had a bloody good go at it, I tell you, because I was getting paid. Every game I played, I gave 100%. And that's how I live my life. I just give everything. And if it's not good enough, it's not good enough. I just wasn't good enough to be in the top league, you know. But at least I can say I've had one game in the top league, which is nice. But the Gillingham game... The both Gillingham games was absolutely phenomenal. I loved every minute, even though we lost the first one. You have to go through the bad things to appreciate the good things, and that's what happened, you know.
So it turned out after the one you won that you're a bit of an impersonator on the side. The Unassociated National Radio show thought they were talking to Andy Thompson, who scored the winning goal, and they got some bloke from Suffolk with a dodgy Scottish accent.
Yeah,
so let's hit the accent.
Oh, no, I'm not going to say it now. I can't. But the thing was, me and Tomo, we didn't go to sleep for 2 nights. Honestly, we were so happy. And obviously, the whole, the team spirit of that squad was incredible. We used to go Tuesdays and Saturdays religiously. It weren't not 3 or 4 of us. It was 15, 20 of us going out in nightclub or bar somewhere, and a Saturday after a game. You know, religiously we done it, and but we could do that then. You know, football has changed a lot. You know, they're more athletes than we were, that's for sure. But what we done, we play hard, but we worked hard as well. You know, we won that game at Wigan, and lots of games building up to. Even in the championship, through team spirit, you know, we had the cream. Tony Pulis would say the cream always comes to the top. You know, we had the Bob Taylors and the Carlos Arbers. They were the cream. The Essentalers, Nicky Southall, they were the cream. They were the top players. You know what I mean? And we used to call ourselves the Eggers at the back, and we were just the Eggers. You know, we had and volleyed and put our bodies on the line every single game. But you need that. We had a great mix, and like I say, we were. That game, that time with Tomo, obviously we won. I think it was at the Hilton in Maidstone. I think it was. We had a little city in the reception. I had a city. He had a city. We were having a drink and this, that, and the other. And we didn't sleep. I think maybe not 4 hours, but 24 hours. We stayed up all night. Stayed up the following day, and then Talk Sport, I think, came on, or one of the national radio stations, what to speak to Tomo. We were still very happy and very merry, still drinking, like I say. I said, let me take it, Tomo, and put a Scottish accent on, and said it, I rose like a salmon, blah, blah, blah. Said stuff that AD Pennant was fantastic and all this, you know, in a Scottish accent. It's the worst Scottish accent in the world. I think they thought I was from Wales anyway. I don't think about Scotland. And they soon turned us off. I think they realised after a minute that they turned us off. But again, it was just... It's a bit of banter that I liked, but it was great.
You're probably well known for your banter and some of your pranks. What were some of your best ones in that squad? What were the funny moments amongst those players?
What that I could tell everybody. Well, even going back to the Bournemouth days, I had this Talbot Samba. It cost me 50 quid. This Talbot Samba, yellow wheels, yellow stripe. And when it rained in Bournemouth. Do you know what I mean? It's obviously in the winter. This time it was torrential rain, puddles everywhere. I had about six. We went training and come back. All about 6-7 lads in my little Talbot Samba, because obviously the worst car around, and the tax was cost more than the car. We was going back past the ticket office in Bournemouth, and this huge puddle, and this bloke was sitting there. This bloke was standing, just got his tickets. He was in a suit, and he said, "I went, watch this, boys." I went and I put my foot down on my Talbot Samba. Please don't do this at home, children, young adults. I went through this puddle and this bloke got covered, and I didn't realise it was the muddiest puddle ever, and he was caked. He was absolutely caked all over from head to toe. The boys are screaming, "Oh my God, Ailey, what have you done?" Da, da, da. Didn't think nothing of it. We parked underneath the, I called it my back cave, because the Talbot Sand, like I say, it was rusty, yellow wheels, yellow stripes, and I put it under the stands, and then next minute, panic from the corridors, panic, F this, and da 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 da. Where are you? And I thought, oh, I might have Malmagent. This bloke went and saw Malmagent and the gaffer and said, this Talbot Sandler went over me, but who done it? Obviously, I was driving it. And then I went into the, all the boys obviously laughing. Malmagent took me into the office, and this bloke was standing there, I'm not joking you, he looked like the mud man, honestly. All I'd done was laugh, and I shouldn't have laughed. Oh my God, it was so funny. But obviously, Mal Machin was furious with me. So I had to pay for his, you know, get his suit clean and new shoes and all that.
For the latest reaction and reports from the games that matter, visit our website at kentonline.co.uk.
At what time did you become serious then, and go into, decide that coaching was going to be for you, that was the way? I mean, you said before you was captain of the youth team. Was it always a leadership quality within Ailey Pennant?
No, I think I had a young family. I was, you know, that's all I knew, was football from a young age. Andy Ford gave me opportunity when I unfortunately had to retire at Gillingham, obviously, because my knee, my reconstruction snapped against Birmingham, playing for Gillingham in the Championship. And I knew then, we're struggling here, I'm struggling to get back in. I tried to come back. I think Hesse was the manager then. I came back against Watford last game of the season, come off the bench, and I tried so hard to carry on the following season. But every time I trained and played, my knee just blew up. My last game for Gillingham, I think, was at Palace away, and I played played in midfield just in front of back four. I loved it, absolutely loved it. Had a good game, I think, on the Tuesday. I think it might have been on television. That was on the Sunday or the Monday. Then we played on the Tuesday or Wednesday away game at Scunthorpe or Scarborough or someone in a cup. Anyway, that night as we travelled in the hotel after the Palace game, I woke up, my knee was huge, it was massive, and I thought, oh gee whiz, and obviously in a lot of pain. My roommate was Vince Bartram. Said, if anything, look at my knee, and it was massive. And so obviously didn't play. Went to the surgeon at Cambridge who'd done it before, and he looked at it, opened me up inside, and just said, I'm sorry, Ailey, you've got to stop, because your knee's like a 95-year-old man. It just completely shot to bits. So unfortunately, I was in tears. Even though I knew deep down I was finished. But I give it a good go. And me being me, I thought, if I went part-time, then that could be all right, you know, training, even though, to be fair, the last year or so, I wasn't training fully at Gillingham because my knee gets swollen up. But Essie was brilliant, and obviously Peter Taylor before that, and obviously Tone. And then I thought, then Andy Ford called me up out of the blue and said, would I like to become like assistant youth coach with Ian Docker at Gravesend and Northfleet, obviously Ebbsfleet now, plus being player, you know, for the first team. So I met Andy and agreed to that. And I thought, oh, this could be an opening into coaching. But I still wanted to play because I love playing. You can't beat playing, you know. And I think I played 8 or 9 games for Gravesend. In every game I was struggling big time. Couldn't train. My knee kept swelling up. I enjoyed it with Docs, with Ian Docker, on the youth side of it. Docs is a very good coach. Good coach, honestly. He was good for me. And, you know, looking back, I was unbelievably raw. You know, I'm not saying I'm perfect now, but I'm just saying, looking back, I was so raw. And Docs was good. He was taking sessions. I was buttoning. He said anything, AD, but it was like to and fro that way. It was great. And the pace scheme was ideal. So I was doing that. Obviously, me being a player plus being a coach for the pace, it made up my money, obviously, to pay the mortgage and other bills. And like I said, a young family. And I had to stop. Basically, I had to stop playing because my knee was not good. And then Phil Hanford was assistant manager then to Andy Ford, and he quit. He quit being assistant manager, and Andy asked me to become first team coach with assistant manager to him for the first team, as well as do the pay scheme, because obviously I couldn't play, so that made a little bit more money up for me. So if again, you know, I'm best mates with Phil Hanford to this day. And if it wasn't for him, obviously he had other commitments, obviously, in his work. But since then, we've become obviously best mates, and still see Phil a lot and speak to him a lot. And then become first team assistant manager there, which I really loved. And then obviously went to Welland after that.
Phil obviously says you're the best window cleaner that's ever worked for him. Isn't
it? Yeah, I know, and people forget. When you're a football player, a professional football player, you're in a bubble. You're in this bubble, and you think it's never going to end. And people think that you're on millions and millions and hundreds of thousands of pounds. And money's never followed me ever anywhere, and I'm not really money orientated either. So when I became Welland manager, obviously because I was assistant manager at Gravesend, and then Welland called me. Paul Parker left. And they called me, asked me, would I become manager there? And I had to weigh up, obviously, financially for me, because obviously, like I say, I've got a mortgage and bills to pay. And so to do the Welland job, obviously, because it was part-time, I spoke to Phil when he was a window cleaner and said there's any work, and I went with Phil to be a window cleaner. So I was up every day, 4 o'clock in the morning with Phil, doing 10 or 12 hours a day. Then in the evening, coming back and being a Welland manager. And I'd done that for 2.5 years. And, I remember my first job. See, Phil's not just a window cleaner. He's a cleaner. He cleans anything, carpets, walls, this, that, and the other. My first job, remember, I was up on a cherry picker. In a summer estate in Gravesend somewhere, and cleaning the top of this factory roof, and it was black. And I'm cleaning up, thinking, not only about a month ago, I was a footballer, do you know what I mean? And, thinking about the Wembley days. But I had to do it because I had to pay the bills, but it done me the world of good. And, I was doing windows up in London with Phil, obviously cleaning, cherry picking, doing high stuff, cleaning ceilings, and even going in apartments where drug dealers were. Used to go in there, and Phil used to get the job to clean it all up, and there was syringes, human waste that I had to clean up. People would forget, but it done me the world of good, because I appreciate it that what other people had done. And when you're a footballer, you are in a bubble, and it was hard work, unbelievably hard work. And I take me out for Phil. Phil's been fantastic for me, obviously as a mate, but also helped me pay the bills for my family also. But again, the Welland, going to Welland, the Hobbins family was incredible. It was perfect for me at Welland. Barry and Graham, and God bless him, Graham was there when he passed away. And Graham passed away, and that's one of the saddest times of my life. Honestly, it was so sad, because we're very close to the Hobbins family, obviously with Barry still being there and Piggy. It was a very sad time when he passed. But that gave me a little stepping stone, obviously, to Tone, because we had a cup run at Welland. Again, it's fate again. We had a cup run at Welland. We went to Huddersfield, if you remember. And the Sun took us on board following Welland through the cup rounds. And we went to Huddersfield in the first round of the FA Cup, which is fantastic. The little old Welland at Huddersfield, and that was when I had a proper taste of so-called the bigger things, you know what I mean? Well, I thought, I could do a bit more of this. I loved it. And we lost 4-1, but we come off the pitch, the crowd are standing up, giving us a standing ovation, because we get had a right old go there. And I remember Chris Moore scored in the last seconds. It was 4-0 down. He scored with a header with the seconds to go. We went ballistic on the bench, and the fans behind, it was a great moment. And, Welland has played and still does play a big part in my life, and that's for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say that Welland is somewhere that you do think very fondly of in your time there. Funny enough, the Huddersfield thing, I've just got to say very quickly, my favourite memory of that cup tie obviously was the hotel the night before, and then waking up the following morning, and one of the kit men, Dave Lodge, going out in the pouring rain getting papers for everyone to read.
That's right.
And he came back like a drowned rat. That was the funniest.
I know. We were so close, though, Matt, weren't we? But we were all very close. And I remember there's another one with Barry. Barry will remember this. I don't know if he will remember it. And we played Thurrock away, and we beat Thurrock. And at the time, Thurrock were the so-called bigger spenders of the league, and we beat them 2-0. And I think I put on radio, we pay peanuts compared to Thurrock. So next time I had a meeting with Barry and Graham, I'm normally one-on-one with Graham, you know, talking about football and everything else. And Barry came in, he had a bag of peanuts. He went, give them to the bloody players. He went, a bag of peanuts. And then you think, oh, yeah, I was, you know, even that was a learning curve for me, because I a little bit disrespect them a little bit, because, you know, they worked so hard to get money in that football club. So that was a learning curve for me, learning what to say on radio and not to say on radio, and respecting everybody. And, you know, because like I say, there's a family run club. Obviously, I went back there when Jamie was there as a so called consultant, and that was a great time, also. You know, we went there and before did the Gillingham come up, you know.
Got to talk to you about Forest Green.
Yeah.
I wondered how you looked back on that time now, not necessarily the start when you were there, but obviously at the end. You had their best ever league season, was it? Finished second in, yeah, at the time. At the time, it was the best ever finish.
Yeah.
Finished second in the National League.
Mm.
But then got the sack a week before the end of the season.
Yep.
And didn't get the chance to manage at Wembley.
No, that is that hurt. Football, Matt, is a ruthless industry. It's not a nice industry at all. You know, obviously, especially on the management stroke coaching side of it, it's not a nice industry at all. And that really opened my eyes up to it, really. We broke about 9 records that season. I went there from Stoke. Obviously, we got sacked from Stoke. Me and Tone got sacked from there, and I wanted to go on my own again. And went there, and Dale Vince was fantastic. And I look back on that as a massive achievement. We turned the whole club around. It wasn't as professional as I wanted it. They were struggling near the bottom half of the conference. We turned it around. I was there 2.5 years, and looking back, it was a great achievement what we done there. We broke loads of records. We went from, I think, 400 on the gate to 2,500, and it's only a small little club, you know, and we had some good times there, really. But I don't want to be here and not Forest Green. That did hurt, though. I got sacked on a hunch, and that really did hurt. I was preparing for it was us and Cheltenham for the title that season. We were to and froing, and then the last 5 games, they won it with 5 games to go. Sorry, Cheltenham won it with 5 games to go. But we was obviously his local derby, Cheltenham Forest Green, so it was very close. So I said to Dale Vince, I said, the chairman, I said, at the last 5 games, I'm going to prepare for the playoffs. So I'm going to give everybody a chance to get match fitness, give everybody so everybody's fit and raring to go for the playoffs. Because we lost the season before to Bristol Rovers in the playoffs, which is our first playoff the club has ever been in. So that was the highest. So we improved from the following season. But that was no disgrace, losing to Bristol Rovers on aggregate the season before. So he said, yeah, he agreed to that. He said, yeah, good idea, blah, blah, blah. So we won, I think we, the last 5 game season, I think we won 2 and drew 3, or 1-2, lost 1, drew 3. So it wasn't great. All season we were flying. But it didn't worry me, because I was getting prepared for the playoffs. And then I had a phone call in Gillingham at home from Dale Vince on a Wednesday. This is before the playoff game against Dover, saying that this is not a good. His words were, "This is not a good conversation I want to make. I'm going to sack you." And I was flabbergasted, Matt. Honestly, I couldn't believe it. I said, "You know, what have I done wrong?" And he said, "You've done nothing wrong." I said, I just think that with you in charge, we're not going to get promoted from Wembley, you know, to get promoted. And so I said, OK, put the phone down. Obviously, I said, OK, put the phone down. And then that really hit me then. I had to speak to the wife, told the wife, spoke to the children. The children loved going up Forest Green. And it was tough to take. And I went up, that was on the Wednesday. I went up the next day, because he said, come in the next day. Went up the following day, met him and the director. I had loads of questions going through my head, loads of questions. And I said, you know, can you tell me what's really going on here? Because I'm flabbergasted. And I said, have I done something untoward? I just do not understand, you know. Broke 9 records and changed the whole club around, and you're not going to give me opportunity to lead the team out from Wembley and this, that and the other. And he said, no. He said, I've just got a hunch. I said, so I've been sacked on a hunch. You've been sacked on a hunch. And I went, I said, well, it's hard to take, but I wish you all the best in the playoffs and obviously at Wembley. Shook his hand, shook the director's hand and walked out. And then I went, I went to the final.
You went to the game?
I went to the game. BT gave me free tickets. I took my older son and my neighbour up there. I think BT planned it, really, because I was on, you know, obviously I got sacked. And I'll tell you, I had so many managers I've never spoken to, I'm talking in the top league, call me and said, they can't believe I've been sacked. And some lovely messages, some really one-on-ones with managers I've kept friendly with and put me in good stead, really, for now. I'm talking about big-name managers. Couldn't believe what had happened. And but I went to the game and I said to my son and my neighbour, you know, they played Grimsby. We were 10 points clear of Grimsby come the end of the season. We finished second, obviously, and Grimsby were third. I said to my son, look, whatever happens, don't cheer if Grimsby's got Grimsby. Obviously, they. But everything changed then, as you imagine. We wanted Grimsby to win. Mark Cooper was on the scene, behind the scenes, or looking back, maybe he was on the scenes because people were telling me this, that, and the other. But again, football is what it is, you know. And obviously, they lost to Grimsby in the final. But how I look at them now, I look at it, and I had a lovely message from Dale Vince, to be fair, from Brunei. He left them a nice message congratulating me. You know, obviously, kept an eye on me in this and the other. So I wouldn't say nothing bad. I just look upon that as a fantastic experience. Loved every minute of it, except for the last phone call I had. you know, even 10 days before that, you know, or a week before that, my wife and children. Dale, Vince's wife and children, we went for a meal and nothing was said, just talking football and life in general, and then I had that phone call. But it's his decision, it's his club, you know, he paid the bills and paid the wages, but I still have utmost respect for the man. And everybody connected to Forest Green, I love seeing them where they are. They'll be in the Championship one day, because his dream and ambition is fantastic, and I look on it with a little smile on my face that we did turn around, which is nice.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
Let's talk about Gillingham next. January 2017, when you became manager. Was that the dream job? An ex-Gillingham player lives locally, takes on a role as manager of his local team?
No. I'm not being horrible. I'm just being totally honest, because I am what I am. I say what it is. And I didn't want the job, I'll be honest with you, because I live locally. The biggest thing, my family, obviously myself and my family, we live local. But again, when I got the call, I've got a family, I've got a mortgage to pay, I've got bills to pay. It was on my doorstep, obviously been away from family from Stoke and Forest Green. And it was a case of coming home and having time with, you know, quality time there. But I didn't want it because it was local. That was the only thing. And there was a lot of things that happened there, which I wasn't there long, obviously, wasn't there long, but a lot of things happened that will blow your mind, really, to be honest with you.
I don't know how much you can say, but what sort of things?
Just the start of it, really. You know, the kit man gave me Justin Edinburgh's kit. You know, is your kit that had J-E on it, you know, his initials on it. And God bless Justin, you know, obviously, again, I've got to put on record, it's absolutely travesty what's happened here. You know, obviously, him not being here no more, God bless him. You know, his wife and children must feel terrible. And what's happened to Justin was, it's broke my heart. But the first week I'm there, we haven't just given me just that professionalism, do you know what I mean? You know, I was a bigger person than Justin, you know. I mean, the size of me, and Justin was a fit boy, and I'm a little bit bigger build than Justin, and to give me his kit, obviously didn't fit. And then there was so many stories. Obviously, the team that I inherited didn't have the same passion and hunger that I had as a player at Gillingham, as well as a manager and everything else. Yes, there was not all of them. I'm not going to tarnish everybody with the same brush, but people were just there for the wrong reasons for Gillingham at the time. You know, if you look at the season, that the team I inherited, obviously, in January, you know, there was players there. Yeah, Josh Wright was fantastic. He scored some unbelievable a lot of goals for us. You know, Cody McDonald scored a lot of goals. I brought in Thomas Holy. You know, Zesh Raymond came in just for experience. But it just... so many things happened in a space of from January to the end of the season. It was incredible. I'm going around London because the secretary had done a mistake. We've signed a player that had already played for two teams. I'm driving around in London at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, trying to him to sign this other paper saying it's void, because he'd otherwise we'd have to pay him the whole of his contract up, and him not even kick a ball in anger for Gillingham. I had a player come up to me after a game. He was coming back from an away game. He was at fault for all three goals, and So we come up, I put the DVD on and showed him the clips, and I had me, Jamie Loves, and the player, I don't want to mention his name, but he said to me, Gaff, I don't want to head the ball from set plays. Pardon? You know, and you think, hang on a minute. You know, and that when he left and when he said that, I looked at the other, Loves and Daisy, I went, have I just heard that right? I had the last game of the season summed up for me where, something happened big at the club, where the police was involved. I was involved, obviously, to do statements and everything else, and had to sack the player for the last game of the season against Northampton away. If people knew what went on, there was games in that period where, towards the end, really, and then in when I left, I had to get on social media. There was people threatening me and my family with putting a petrol bomb through the window, and with my wife and children in the house, wanting to kill my family if I didn't leave the football club. You know, slashing the brakes on my car with my wife and children in, and my grandson, and that was the last straw for me. And I'm thinking, really, if they really knew what was going on, you know, I just thought, did I deserve all this? And then I said to my wife, that's me done. You know, I can't do this. My house has got, I had to get secure. I've got cameras on the house. I've got, alarms on my house. I've got all lights, security lights on the house. Because people might say, well, why didn't you go to the police? I did. I went to the police. I spoke to them. I showed them four or five people what people were saying if I didn't leave the club, and they said, "Yeah, well, we could warn them, because there's no rule about them saying what they say. We could warn them." But I said to my wife, "There's no point going through with it because I live here. My wife and children live here. For the rest of my life, I'd have to look over my shoulder if I went further with it." But that's what social media does. It's horrendous, social media. I don't do social media. Then I'm on Instagram now, and because obviously I'm in Brunei, and it's nice to show everybody obviously what's been happening in Brunei. But at the time, I was on Facebook for a year because my daughter lives in Bournemouth, and these people were messaging me on FaceTime and saying unbelievable stuff. You know, even on YouTube, people saying stuff. And you think, really, if you knew what was going on, then you wouldn't be saying these things. You know, at the end of that season, when we drew with at Northampton, the chairman came on the pitch and said, "Oh, we can't have this." AD Nick, really, Mr. Chairman, after you know what's been going on, there's no money there to get anybody in. You know, we got Thomas Holly in, which is a big thing, and even with Thomas, funny enough, he's at Ipswich now, but I said, I said, put him on a 10-year contract because he's young, he's got fantastic tools, you make money. Didn't put him on a long contract, but little things like that, I'm really proud that he's playing. Everybody I got rid of, well, to be fair, going to the end, we stayed up. And then the following pre-season, in that summer, I had 5 days off. I didn't know if I was manager or not. The chairman went away trying to get the investments into the football club. He went away. I didn't hear from him for a couple of months. I'm at the stadium for 5 days. We went to Centre Parks for 5 days. I was in every single day trying to see what players we can get in and shuffling things around, and players I can get rid of and shuffling things around, this, that, and the other. My wife thought I was crazy, didn't know if I had a job or not. I walked in just before pre-season, and the chairman was there with Peter Taylor, and sat there, and Peter Taylor was shocked. He said, "Oh, do you not know I was going to come in as director of football?" No, I didn't even know if I was going to be manager or not. I knew that the chairman obviously spoke to a manager who everybody wanted in Kent, Gillingham fans wanted in Kent, because this manager called me, said that the chairman had spoken to him. He said, "If you double AD's wages and triple the budget, yeah, I'll come." But obviously he didn't. People were right. Maybe I was a cheaper option. But I had, like I say, 5 days in that pre-season, especially with what happened and then 4 months before, I could say much more. But so what happened was Peter came in as director of football. And I love Peter Bits. I love him to bits, Peter. Unbelievable good coach, really good coach, good man. I thought, yeah, okay, if that's what the way the chairman would respect what the chairman said. Obviously, he offered me the job again. Obviously, again, we had the bills to pay, so I could not. I didn't decline, and I really thought I could turn it around. You know, obviously, with a pre-season, with my own players coming in, blah blah blah. So Peter was shocked that I didn't know that he was coming in, but that was by Dubai. Had meetings with Peter and Peter and the chairman wanted me to do a list of players who I wanted to bring in. So I gave them a list of players, A, B and C. A being players that we'd have to pay money for, that, you know, that we'd want to go for the championship, you know, because I don't want to just be, I didn't want to come in and just be bottom half of the table. So I had a list of A players who would cost a couple of bob, B players who were free but not paid as much as the others, and C was a lot of academy players, up and coming young kids that I know. So I had A, B and C list of players, gave it to Peter. Peter said, and I'll say, you know, Peter knows, you know, I'm not afraid to say it, but, and it's nothing to be embarrassed about, but he screwed three papers up and said, "Aidy, you got no chance." He said, "You can't even get player C on that list." So I said, "Wow." And he said, he couldn't believe how what I'd done the season before, because that was just a little small miracle, what we'd done, keeping them in the league. If, like I say, I can't say too much what was going on. But, you know, so I got Gabri Sequani in. Everyone's telling me not to take Tom Eaves in because he was just headless chicken, but I knew that was, I brought players in who would fight for the shirt, you know, who would really run around and sweat blood, tears for that shirt, because most of the players the season before didn't care. They didn't, I promise you, they didn't care. And obviously that's a team I inherited, and it's always tough to inherit a team. Not all of them, though. I'm not saying this all of them, I'm not tarnishing everybody with the same brush, but we started, obviously started the season, and then it really come to a head. You know, obviously, I'm talking about, I had to get players in on £400-£500 a week. We're talking about the Division One league here, you know, Division One, and Gabby was great, Thomas Holly was great, Tom Eaves was fantastic. And looking back, everybody who I released the season, at that pre-season, nobody's bit me on the bum and said, you know, oh, he's playing in Championship, they're playing Division 2 or Conference or even lower. The players that I left Steve with, or Peter Taylor, obviously, was temporary charge, and Steve Loves, they all went on to do good stuff, you know, better stuff. So I was pleased about that. But it come to a head, really. We played, I was walking my son back to the car park, and these lads, 19, 20-year-olds, come behind me and spat at the back of my head. I had my young son with me, and I thought, if I didn't have my young son, I didn't care if I was manager of Gillingham or not. Nobody spits you in the back of the head. They were saying stuff, people were saying stuff from cars, and again, I had my family there, and my family and my life. And it came to a head when the Charlton home game, it was my last home game, there was rumours that Nobby Solano was going to become Gillingham manager. So I had phone calls on the Friday night before the Charlton game, saying, Nobby's, you know, from yourselves, from television, say, would you like to say anything about Nobby Solano being the manager? And I said, I don't got a clue. It's a Friday night, I'm with the family, and I'm preparing for the Charlton game on the Saturday. You know, we didn't have a great start, I know that. And then we beat Charlton 1-0. But the chairman came in before the Charlton game, and he came in. I said, "Chairman, what's going on with Nobby Solano stuff?" And he went, "Hey, I've only spoken to him to his agent on email." I said, "So it's true then?" He went, "Well, it could be, you know." I said, fair enough. So I just thought, right, let's get the Charlton. Let's win. We won the Charlton game. Most probably messed up a lot of things. We won the Charlton game. Then we went to Rochdale on the following Saturday. We lost that game. Tommy's got sent off in the first 5 minutes. I said to Tanya, that's me done. I can't do anymore. You know, with all the stuff that's been going on behind the scenes, and it's nothing to do with obviously the chairman. It was other stuff going on. We just didn't get the fair crack. I was there to be shot at from the start. So after the Rochdale game, I said, come back. My brother was there at the Rochdale game, funny enough, because he lives in Liverpool. I said, that's me done, Stu. Because he was, obviously, we're a very close family. I'm going back a little bit, but at the start of when Paul Scully offered me the job in January after Justin left, my brother, a month before my brother suddenly passed away. So, again, that wasn't, it wasn't great. He suddenly passed away a month before I got the Gillingham job as manager. So that was a tough time. So I was still going through a little bit, obviously, grieving on that. But when I left, after the Rochdale game, I come back, I said to my wife, right, I said, we're going to, this is on Sunday now, I said, let's go to the club. I said, I cleaned out, nobody was in, I'd obviously had a key to get in. I washed the car, we had a company car, washed the car inside and out. It's immaculate. I got every single bit of Gillingham kit in a bag. I cleaned out the office, Obviously, Sunday, all this happened on Sunday. Obviously, myself, Peter, and the chairman always had meetings on a Monday anyway with the game and talk about football and obviously everything else, which is always good. But we sat, I sat down, came in. Chairman said on social media, they're not having your aid and it's tough. Da, da, da. I said, yeah, no, I understand. And I said, yeah, no. I said, Mr. Chairman, come on, let's finish and, you know, part ways. Shook his hand and said, thank you very much for the opportunity. And obviously Peter, but obviously said to the chairman, wish you all the best, thank you for the opportunity being the manager. And he said, well, I'll give you an hour or two to clean your... I said, no, Mr. Chairman, here you go. This is the keys to my car. Here's a bag with my kit in. And he said, what about your office? I said, I've done it all last night, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And shook his hand and went out. And I got home, and I'm promising you now, gents, I got home and went... Whew, it was a massive release. It was a huge release because it, you know, after, I don't know if you remember, after the Northampton game when we stayed up, I was so emotional, just through mentally and physically. I was drained, mentally drained. What went on in those 4 or 5 months, I was mentally drained. And I can't say everything what went on, but if people knew what I put in, absolutely everything in that, because I want to be successful. And like all jobs, you know, but that was my time at Gillingham. But again, people say, I'm not going to be on here and say I'm a Paul Scully basher and this, that and the other, because what Paul Scully has done, you know, he's got a wonderful family, you know, lovely wife, lovely family, his boys and girls. And the chairman's had a massive heart operation. I didn't know that until I saw him. I hadn't spoken to him for years, obviously, when we first spoke, but the Gillingham take the job up. He's nearly died for the club, you know, and what all I'd say on it is now, obviously, the first 10 years, he's been unbelievable. You know, obviously, with what he'd done with Tony, with Peter, with Essie, the best times of the club in history. But I even said to him, I said, why are you doing it now? Just sell up. You know, why kill yourself? You know, you should go and, you know, you want to see your grandchildren, you know, children have children, so you want to see your grandchildren grow up. And I told him face to face, and he, you know, I said, why are you doing it? Because he's a one-man band. He does it on his own, you know. He goes around the world trying to get obviously investments in, which actually at the moment it's not happening. But if I was him, I just, you know, he's been, like I say, I think the club is stuck at the moment. You know, it's stuck. I'm not bashing him. I just think that, you know, potentially the club has got everything. I think the young generation that's come through don't really know me, and obviously they were the ones giving me the so-called grief, which happens in football. I think the club is stuck where we do need an investment and need an injection. And I think, like I say, the first 10 years, Paul Scully we were flying, you know, obviously in the championship and everything else. But it's just stuck in the moment. And the only way, you know, we can get in the championship, back in the championship, genuinely get back in the championship, is by having that injection of cash, because it's tough. It is tough. People say, oh, we're Bournemouth in the Premiership. Well, Bournemouth spent hundreds of millions of pounds, you know, and obviously I'm not saying Gillingham got to spend hundreds of millions of pounds, but I think that if I was a chairman, I'd say, you know, he'll go down in history as obviously the best chairman. But the last 5, 6, 7 years has been very tough for him. And like I say, he's had a massive operation. I think he's took it too lightly, me personally. I think he took it too lightly, and he should... You know, just hold down tools and say thank you very much. I can't do no more. I'm going to spend time with my family and live happily ever after. And that's what I'll do.
What did he say when you said that to him?
Yes, he said, "Oh yes." We had some good conversations. I'm not a yes man. You know, I'm never have been a yes man. What people say in the press, what people say on social media. I'm an ex player who's come in and just been a yes man. I'm never a yes man in my life. Speak to Tony Pulis about that. That's why Tony likes me and why I've got on with other people. And obviously, I've got utmost respect for the chairman of Gillingham, Paul Scully, but I'm not a yes man. When I said those things, you know, it's his life, isn't it? It's his life. You know, he gets up in the morning, he's been the Gillingham chairman. But me personally, like I say, he's got a wonderful family and who adores him, but he's had a massive heart operation. Massive, honestly. You should see his chest, like the M25 map it is. And I say, enough is enough. You know, let someone else have a go now. Or I know he's trying to sell it, but I'd do what he done. I'd let it go for a pound, let them take on all the debts, let them sell it for a pound, and because, like I say, he's done well in the first few years.
Knowing what you know now and what you went through and your family went through, if you rewind the clock, would you take the Gillingham job if it was offered to you tomorrow?
Never. My family comes first, Matt. Honestly, why should I put cameras and alarms and lights on the house, because you know, we were, you know, the things that people were saying was horrendous. I just can't believe it. And if everybody knows me truly, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I give everything. I think I'm a genuine nice fella, you know. And I certainly didn't deserve my wife and children, what they said about, you know, putting a petrol bomb through the window and this, that, and the other. And it scared me. I kept away from the children, but they're older now, so they can know. But me and my wife, we were scared, you know. And we're talking about Gillingham. We're not talking about blooming Bayern Munich or blooming Arsenal or Juventus of the world. Do you know what I mean? We're talking about Gillingham. And it was more so the younger generation, obviously. The older generation knows me well. But what I know now, but then again, I had to pay the bills. People don't realise I had to pay the bills, you know. And people say, why didn't I walk at the end of that season? But, well, who's going to pay the bills? You know, I didn't want my family on the street. I'm a working man. Like I say, I've cleaned windows, I've shovelled human waste and gotten, you know, picked up human waste and this, that, and the other. I've been on that side, so why should I, you know? And I thought that if I was given a little bit, you know, even if I went on the C paper, you know, not okay, A, I understand, B, I understand, but C paper, you know, on the list I had for C players, if I had that, we'd have been, you know, mid table plus. But my hands were tied, I was there to be shot at, but Peter Taylor knew what went on. You know, he couldn't believe it. He'd never known nothing like it. But again, I go back to like my playing days. You have to go for the worst to enjoy the good, you know. And I'm enjoying the good, obviously, being that. But I tell you what happened after that. The shot in the arm I had after that, I went to Barrow. Barrow was struggling. You know, they told me to keep them in the league. Basically, we kept them in the league, and I needed that. And I'll be honest with you, Matt, I wanted to get away from Midway. I did. Everywhere I went, I didn't want to go out of the house, because I was scared because of what happened with what people were saying. I wanted to protect my family, and me going to Barra took all that away, because obviously people knew I wasn't around in Midway. They knew I was up in Manchester, obviously, where we trained in Rochdale, or up in Barra.
After Barrow, Maidstone came up, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, yeah.
Jay Saunders had left, and I think you spoke to the owners and to Bill Williams, the chief exec, and but perhaps the local thing there was an issue, was it?
Yeah, after Barra, obviously I left Barra only because the owner said that he was going to leave, and he was on what got me there. And I said, you know, I'd done what I'd done, had to do. I didn't know what was going to happen after that, so I wanted to come home. My wife said, why don't you get your knee done now? My knee was knackered, so I had my knee replaced. So I had that replaced, and then, Maidstone, I had a phone call from Maidstone, wanted me to come and speak to them after Jay left. The three gentlemen I spoke to were absolutely brilliant. You know, offered me the job there. But I was honest with them from the first meeting I had with them. This is when I had a conversation on the telephone with DPMM, Brunei DPMM. So when I went and spoke, because I didn't know if it was true or not. I didn't know if it was concrete. You know, I'm talking about Brunei. I didn't know if that was concrete or not. So I spoke to the gentleman, and it just went. We were sitting there for about 4 or 5 hours. It was really good. It was good chat to them. Though obviously, it's a lovely football club. It's a good football club. You know, family orientated. It was just around the corner. Yeah, I did say to my wife, you know, do I want to put that through? You know, if it didn't go well, do I have to put the family through all that again? And then I couldn't go further away. Could I go to Brunei after Mason offered me the job? But yeah, I did. I was honest with them and just said, look, this is Brunei DPM have come in. They want me to go over to Brunei to have a look and meet them, etc. Blah blah blah. And then literally 2 days later, I called them up and just said, can I come in and speak to them face to face? I didn't want to do it on the phone. I just, because I respect them so much at Maidstone. I just said, look, they've offered me the DPMM want me to go over there. I don't want to mess you about. I'm sorry, I have to decline, but hopefully we'll work together in the future, because, you know, it is a good football club. It's a lovely football club, really good. I went there obviously with Barrow. We won there at Barrow 1-0, and but I just had a good vibe about the place. And that the club will go places. You know, they will definitely go places. And they've got relegated in the conference itself, but you know what? Why couldn't they go in the Football League? You know, they've got everything there. They've got a structure there from youth set up upwards to the first. You know, why can't they? You know, they've got some good ambitions. And the biggest thing is they've got the crowd. They've got the crowd is there. You know, when it's successful, the crowd will come back, and they're noisy, they're passionate. Like I said, it's a family orientated club. So it was a tough one to turn down. I promise you, it was a tough one to turn down. But they were, you know, who say maybe in the future, we'll see.
Adi, we'll finish off with the quick fire questions.
Oh, yeah.
Best goal you've ever scored?
Oh, crumbs. Bournemouth against Swansea. It was at Bournemouth and we were winning 2-0. Swansea come back to 2-2. I was playing midfield that day and 91st minute, ball come out about 30 yards out. It could have been 10 yards out, mate. Let's say 30 yards out. It sounded really good. But I hit it first time, went right in the bottom corner. Didn't, honestly, but inch above the floor. It was a very sweet, sweet strike. And we won the game 3-2, obviously. It was just, obviously, because I scored very rarely, dotted his score. And it was just the noise was phenomenal. We won the game 3-2, so that's the best goal.
We may already know the answer to this one. Favourite ground you played at?
Obviously, Wembley. You can't beat Wembley. And obviously, I played at the old, two games at the old, and obviously been a coach at the new as well, so I've been very, very fortunate. But yeah, so at Wembley, and Portman Road don't come too far away either. Portman Road is, I love Portman Road.
Toughest opponent you played against?
Gianfranco Zola. I think Zola's the toughest one. We played him in the cup, if you remember. We played Chelsea away in the quarterfinals, the FA Cup, was at Gillingham. I just saw the back of his shirt. I thought, he was such a, his balance, left, he went left, right. Obviously, he was just a phenomenal player for me. Earlier days, I played against Noel Quinn. I was playing in the reserves then. We played Arsenal reserves, and Noel Quinn, obviously, was come back from fitness, and I played against him, and he was fantastic. Oh, what a player he was. His touch for a big fella was phenomenal. And he was a handful. But I think actually playing in a first team game would be Zola.
You've obviously managed various clubs. What's been your best signing as a manager? Not necessarily in terms of the player who was the greatest, but the one that you thought, I'm never going to get him to play for my team, but you've actually managed to convince him to come.
Do you know what? I'd go back, even back to Danny Kedwell. You know, kids. I got kids from Herne Bay. I went to Herne Bay. People were saying, don't touch kids for Barge. But I was well a manager. Don't touch him. He's a drinker. He does this. He does that off the pitch. And he won't do this for your aid. But I went to Herne Bay, watched him two or three times. I liked what I saw. Very raw. Got him to Welland. I picked him up every single training session, every single game that I picked him up, dropped him off, picked him up, dropped him off. He never. So I made sure I kept an eye on him. He was brilliant for us. And I know, obviously, it's his non-league days, but he's had a great career, very good career, you know. And I think that would give me a lot of satisfaction with kids. Louis Malt, when I was youth team coach at Stoke City, Louis had a really good career. He lost his mum early doors in his life, bless him, and took him under my wing, and has had a very good career. Played up in Scotland, played in the Championship, scored goals everywhere he's been. So it gave me, it's a nice satisfaction, that one, because of it was then getting through a bad time of his life, and that's what was nice.
One other one was your old friend Trigger. Favourite Trigger moment?
Oh, crumbs. Favourite Trigger moment, I think maybe when he turned up a night out. We had, he had a burn mark on his chest. Obviously, everyone's saying, what have you done, Trig? He said, look, I had a crease in my shirt. So he actually put the iron on, obviously ironed his shirt with it on, so he obviously burnt his chest. Another time he glued his hubcap. He told us a story, it's so funny, that his wheel caps were getting nicked from back home. So what he'd done, he super glued them on. But so obviously he got a puncher, couldn't get him off. Trig was great, but again, he was you know, great lad, Trig, but good player. What a play. He scored some goals for us. And he went to Bolton, didn't he, I think, from us. So it was good, and all the players that I played with and obviously managed and coached or whatever, I love to see good people do well. And I think that's something in this country, especially, don't like seeing. I don't think people like seeing people do well. We like the losers in this country, in my opinion. I always like to see people do well, be it in whatever business they're in.
Time has beaten us. It's been absolutely brilliant having you in for the last hour or so. We'll let you go back to your newfound friends with the Sultan of Brunei.
Yeah, thank you.
You've left us alone now. Thanks very much for your time. We really do appreciate it, and the honesty and how open you've been with us over your career. And we wish you well back in Brunei at the turn of the year.
Thank you very much. Thank you, gents.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audio Boom and iTunes and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.